I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In May, the White House announced an assistance package to help farmers affected by tariffs from China. But food producers want trade, not aid. Today, how tariffs are affecting growers, business owners, and consumers. If you survived a 10% increase in the first round of levies on Chinese goods, your wallet may not be so lucky now that the second round bump has upped tariffs to 25%. Then, sports news out this morning could have big implications for Kansas City. Reporter Greg Eklund broke the story. He'll be here to explain that and give us a rundown of the latest on our area teams and athletes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The cost of the latest round of tariffs against China that the Trump administration announced last month, that would be a cool $760 for the average family of four, according to a trade partnership. Yes, the price of clothes, electronics, even toys are expected to rise, picking up the tab our American consumers. Now a conversation about the impact of all this and how one area retailer is managing. With us, Seth Frieden is the owner of U.S. Toy in Grandview that's been impacted by tariffs. Seth, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having us.
Dan Owens teaches economics at Johnson County Community College. Dan, good morning to you.
Hi, Steve. It's great to be here.
Seth, let's talk about your business, U.S. Toy. Why are you impacted at all by these tariffs? What's happening here?
So most people don't know, but we actually have more than just a retail store. Most people are familiar with our retail store on State Line, which we just relocated 2 weeks ago to 119th and Metcalf.
Right.
But we actually have a warehouse, a corporate office, and most of our business is catalog, internet, and B2B. So we sell all over
B2B
the United States.
B2B is?
Business to business.
Ah, okay.
So we sell to, you know, Cracker Barrel, Chuck E. Cheese, large entities. And so we turn around and resell our product, but we're the ones designing, developing, and OEM importing it, original equipment manufacturing it overseas in China. So we are importing ourselves.
So be specific here, if you would. Which of your products are made in China? What types of toys are we talking about?
So I brought a catalog to show you,
but
it doesn't help everyone on the radio.
Yes.
But we have all types of novelty toys. So if you want to see that,
yeah.
There's all types of novelty toys, everything from inflates to bouncy balls to spider rings, anything party favor you'd find or party supply you'd find for a kid's birthday party.
So lots of different things here.
Lots
I'm looking at spaceships and inflatable pools and all kinds of things here.
There's about 4,000 items in that product line. And then we also sell to early childhood institutions. So this is our educational line. So anything you'll find in a early childhood preschool classroom, Head Start, YMCA, anyone that's got an early childhood educational program, we supply all that product line for them.
So we could just spend the rest of the time here shopping here online
and
see what we can buy here. Yeah, you know, you were able to absorb the impact of the first round of tariffs. Why?
Because we have an inventory management system. So our merchants, we have about six merchants on our staff. So they're the ones that go overseas and work with our partners. But they have to keep forecasts ahead of time because it takes about 6 months from lead time when you have to order a product. And you want to make sure you have safety stock on your best sellers so you don't run out. So we have plenty of stock. We're 94% in stock across our line. So that gives us a barrier until we have to go reorder product for the next round. So we're not in the reordering cycle. We're always in the reordering cycle, but we have enough product to give us a little bit of a cushion until we have to reorder where the tariffs will hit us.
This latest tariff bump then, how does that change your math?
So the phase three went in on the list and that was 10%. That hit us on our keychains and our paper good items. So 10% you can kind of play with and absorb a little bit. But when we get to 25%, we're going to have to readjust our pricing. And luckily, our catalog cycle, we don't go...
25% is what this next round calls for.
And we don't know yet, but if that goes into effect, then we'll have to react to that. And we have time, like I said, built in, but it'll probably be in our next catalog cycle, which will hit in January. So we'll be redoing our pricing, you know, September, October, November, and kind of factor in which items can we absorb some, which items can we pass on, because we can't absorb all 25%. That would not be possible.
You know, you told KSHB in May, Seth, that there would be a little bit of a time lag before this latest tariff would have an impact. Has that time lag expired yet?
No, I mean, that's where I mentioned to you. Yeah, the safety stock. So we're still good on our safety stocks. On certain items, yes. It's not across the board, but you know, it's an item by item basis of how quickly we sell through those items.
Generally speaking, how much more time do you have before the impact would begin to sink in?
About 5 to 6 months. You know, that's about how much stock we keep.
What kinds of price hikes on your products would you be looking at then once this time passes?
You know, we're going to pass on as little as we can, but there will be, you know, probably double digit, you know, price increase, which we don't like to do. You know, that, you know, that's makes us less competitive. And we are a merchant team. They are shopping overseas. We're looking at, we obviously buy from Thailand. We buy from other countries too. We buy from Vietnam. So when our merchants go over there, they're looking at other places as well to see if we can resource. But this, the whole thing is kind of a diversion from what we, you know, I want them developing product, not looking to source items that we already have a good factory connection for. And we've already done the safety testing for. So if we move that factory, you know, there's also toy safety testing laws we have to abide by, and we have to make sure that those things are in compliance. And then the cost to ship out of Taiwan or Thailand or wherever else, the port of export may be more expensive than us to do it from China. So we may be at a net neutral spot anyways, even if we have a cheaper product price. So there's a lot of factors that go into this.
So if you are forced to bump prices even by low double digits, what does that do to your business? What's the impact?
I we haven't been through it, so I don't know. I can't tell you.
What are you expecting?
I would expect that they're going to go shop with our competitors and they're going to see the same thing. You know, I don't think anyone's immune to this. In our industry, in the novelty toy world, there isn't, there's no manufacturing of that anywhere else. It's really, most of it, China has the infrastructure for it. They have all the raw materials and all the labor, and that's their strategic advantage, is the labor. So no one wants to, you know, people don't realize that those 12 yo-yos that go into that bag, well, all those yo-yos were hand-wound. They don't come out of a machine, spit out of a machine. You know, the plastic parts have to be put together with the string put in the middle, and then someone has to hand wind that, and then someone has to count 12 of them, put them in a bag, and then they staple it shut. That's all. That's not automated. Those are all people's jobs in China.
So a lot of chaos here.
Potentially. I mean, disruption is the way I'd put it.
Yeah. Well, Daniel Owens from Johnson County Community College, I want to bring you into this here. How would you describe the impact of this latest round of tariffs against China? What are you seeing?
Well, you know, tariffs are taxes, and anytime you tax something, both sides of the markets pay it. So the gas tax, we consumers are supposed to pay that when we buy gas, but oil companies pay some of that tax. BP and ExxonMobil pay some of the gas tax. And when we tax Chinese products or Mexican products, American consumers are facing a tax increase. That means they'll buy less.
We just heard Seth say there's been a lag time built in because of his ability to stock certain items. What impact are you seeing on American consumers today because of all this?
The immediate impact is in a lot of supply chains. So, for example, the tariffs on steel, a lot of American companies use imported steel to make products here in the United States, and that makes those products more expensive. If you have to pay more money for them, then you're effectively paying a higher tax.
Give us some context here, Dan, because our trade issues extend beyond China right now. Tell us about that. Who else, whether other countries are involved in all this?
Well, there's been a renegotiation of the NAFTA agreement. We have a free trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. And, you know, all trade agreements need to be revisited from time to time. We also have very good trade relationships with our European allies, with Japan, and all of those relationships are potentially affected because we're not negotiating as a team as much as we used to, and instead unilaterally saying we're going to raise tariffs unless.
You know, ultimately, we're heavily reliant on China. Why?
Well, China's been a rising manufacturing source, and it's not just that we're reliant on them to make stuff for us. We sell a lot of things to China. There's plenty of Missouri and Kansas soybean farmers and sorghum farmers and corn farmers.
We're going to talk to the head of the Kansas Farm Bureau here in just a second.
No, we sell a lot of products. We sell a lot of services to China. You know, they're buying our episodes of Ozark and The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other impacts. You know, Tomstown is a distillery here in Kansas City. And if China's retaliated by placing higher tariffs on American bourbon, and that means large distilleries here will start selling more bourbon here, which will lower the price, and that can negatively impact smaller distilleries like Tomstown.
Huh. So is President Trump then, is he leveling the playing field between nations here, Dan? Is he doing something that previous administrations should have done?
I don't think so. I think the president is trying to use tariffs as a bargaining chip.
To achieve what?
To achieve a fairer trading relationship. And all presidents do some of that. President Obama raised tariffs on Chinese tires. President Bush raised them on steel. But we like that to be the exception. You know, the lower tariffs around the world has actually been a great American foreign policy achievement. And it's led to not only more prosperity, but to more peace and friendly relationships.
No question that President Trump is being more aggressive than his predecessors here.
That's correct.
Yeah. Is he going to win this battle? Do you have any sense yet?
Probably not. We sort of saw that with the NAFTA agreement. I think the new one is called USMCA. And it's got some improvements to NAFTA. So in that sense, we're, you know, that's every agreement probably needs to be revisited from time to time. But the benefits of free trade are so overwhelming that ultimately those economic forces are going to win out.
How much longer is this going to last then?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen in the next election. President Trump is pretty committed to the tariffs. I think he kind of has a zero-sum thinking about negotiating through by making demands.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we're seeing other institutions like the Federal Reserve, which are responding and helping level out some of these more confrontational approaches. So I think we're going to be fine.
You know, Seth, you employ 150 workers at U.S. Toy. Have you hired anyone or laid anybody off since the tariffs went into effect?
No, it hasn't affected our workforce at all. Like I said, I think the only meaningful impact that we've had is a small on a couple product lines, but some of our competitors actually sent out letters to their customers. And so, you know, they're informing their customers that stuff is coming. So I don't think that in the business world, everyone kind of knows that, you know, this is on the news for a reason. You know, I think everyone kind of knows what's happening here and that, you know, they're not as naive to think that the this isn't getting passed on.
And just a final point, Seth, you told KSHB that you had a message for the Trump administration, and that was they should put a little more thought into what they're trying to accomplish and who it really does impact, because there will be some impact, you said. Elaborate on that a bit. I mean, what do you mean that a little more thought should have been put into this?
Well, it seems like he's just shooting from the hip, you know, and just pushing these tariffs out to try to achieve a goal. But there's better ways to do this. I mean, Thomas Friedman was on CNBC the other day, you know, and he was saying that this could have been done behind closed doors instead of calling people out and making it so public and putting it on Twitter and all these things. You know, there's probably a better way to accomplish this. And that takes planning and thought and negotiation. Probably when Obama did his tire tariff, he didn't just, you know, rush in and say, here's what we're doing. And, you know, there's no time. We as business owners have to react to things. And the only thing constant is change, but we need to be able to, you know, plan for some things. You know, these are big movements across major industries, not just my, you know, the toy industry. But this is the entire, you know, entire product line coming to the United States.
And Dan, a final point with you. Trade talks now are resuming with China before next week's G20 summit over in Japan. What are you expecting? Or is it simply impossible to say?
I think both sides are in a pretty confrontational place right now. And the president also, I think as part of his reelection campaign, is very committed to the tariffs. So I don't see any progress happening before that meeting.
Okay, I want to bring another voice into our conversation here, and that's the voice of Rich Feltz. He's president of a Kansas Farm Bureau and a Montgomery County farmer. Rich, good morning. Thank you for taking some time.
Yes, good morning as well. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you folks.
Rich, if you would, give us an update on how the trade battles are impacting farmers across Kansas. Who's been the most effective? What are you seeing across the state these days?
Well, agriculture in general has been impacted significantly, but there's no question, and we talk about China, that the soybean producer has been the most affected. If you look at the numbers and the amount of soybeans that we were exporting to China and the percentage of our exports that were going to that country.
You told our producer that we've been able to stimulate demand, so we've not been totally handcuffed. What did you mean by that?
Well, there's been a few of our smaller countries around the world that we've been able to pick up some demand from. And then in the case of soybeans, there's no question that there's some of those beans that have been exported and reflagged that end up in China.
Hmm. Have any farmers gone underwater as a result of this trade fight?
No, I don't think it's that we can say that at this point. But, you know, you're talking about something in the big scheme of things, that this is relatively short period of time. And they have implemented that market facilitation program that has provided a little bit of economic relief to some of these producers.
How much longer can this go on, Rich, but, you know, before a greater sense of unease settles across the state of Kansas and elsewhere for that matter?
Well, I think it's a little hard to say, but as each day goes by, I think people become a little less patient. But I think in the case of agriculture, it's one of these looking at the case of the better good, and you see that there was some rationale to some of these tariff implications, and not that we agree with all of them. And hearing your other presenter, I disagree just a little bit in the fact that you know, a lot of these issues have been accumulating over the years with unfair trade practices, integral property rights, and some things that we've been disadvantaged from, and the president's finally said enough is enough.
I was going to say, what is the rationale here as far as these unfair trade practices? Describe that to me.
Well, the fact that here again, when we look at industry, have we been discriminated against? We've undervalued a lot of the products that we're able to do. There's been some cyber espionage that's gone on. A lot of our people that we have visited with from the trade agency, they talk about lack of inappropriate reporting that goes on to the World Trade Organization when it comes to ag commodities specifically. Some of those type of things are the issues that they're wanting to get addressed in an agreement on these trade issues.
So it sounds like you're saying, Rich, that a lot of your farmers still believe the president's doing the right thing here.
Well, I think in principle, yes, they do. And I don't think there's any question when you look at the trade surpluses that we've been able to have in agriculture with China, that we've kind of bore a disproportionate amount of the pain in this. But yes, I think they feel like for the better good, you know, this is still good to stay in place. But patients are probably wearing a little bit thinner as time goes on.
What will a win look like to you?
Well, a win will us. I think whenever we get some, and hopefully as the president meets this week with leadership in China, that, you know, we can start opening up and have some positive dialogue. We talked about earlier, he was talking about the USMCA. I think that's a win. We in agriculture just feel like we've got to have a win on one of these fronts that we've got some trade issues right now.
I was going to say, Rich, the St. Joseph News Press, which is obviously just on the Missouri side of the state line, just ran an editorial that said this, and I'm quoting here, "The question many of us should ask is what exactly are we fighting for in this trade war? Is it greater access for U.S. exports, protection for domestic industries, national security, or the elimination of China's theft of U.S. technology and trade secrets? Is the president just bothered by the trade imbalance or using tariff payments as a bargaining chip?" In other words, that paper is saying we don't really know what this battle's all about. Do you?
Well, I think the trade imbalance, but I think if you look at any economy and it's good to trade, there's people that have cost productions in different areas that are better than what you have. But by the same token, I think if we look at industry and seeing some of the infringements that we've had, those property rights that have been befriended and those type of things, I think that's what we're holding out for. And also accountability for them. Whenever they raise ag commodities, for example, they underreport what they do. They subsidize that production unfairly. Those are the kind of issues that we need to get rectified.
And Rich, just a final point. The Wall Street Journal just reported that throughout much of the Midwest, U.S. farmers are filing for Chapter 12 bankruptcy protection at levels not seen for at least a decade. What do you make of it?
Well, I think there's a little bit of that starting to happen. We personally have not experienced that in some of our conversations. But we've had some economic strife. We've had some production issues going into any of this trade disruption that we've had. So some of these economic strife has come about before this trade issue. No question, it's kind of exemplified it a little bit, but the issue has been there with the economics anyway. But we do not need to see that in any industry, particularly in agriculture, at a time when we're trying to feed the world.
That's Rich Feltz. He's president of the Kansas Farm Bureau. Rich, thanks for taking some time.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciated the opportunity.
I also want to thank my in-studio guest, Seth Frieden, owner of U.S. Toy in Grandview. Good luck down the road.
Thank you.
You're curious to see what happens to you, Seth. Dan Owens teaches economics at Johnson County Community College. Dan, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk sports with Greg Eklund. We'll talk Chiefs, we'll talk Royals, and we'll talk USA Gymnastics. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund is here to kick around the latest in the area sports. One question I'll throw at Greg, is the new-look Chiefs defense really going to be that much better? And can Pat Mahomes, in his second year as a starting NFL quarterback, really be any better? We'll also talk Royals and Sporting KC and Women's World Cup soccer, and a breaking story this morning about USA Gymnastics and a new training center that could be coming to Kansas City. Greg, welcome back.
Good morning, Steve.
Tell us about this story about a new training center. This is a significant deal.
Well, it's something that USA Gymnastics has been talking about for a while now, since the Caroli Ranch has been closed down in the Houston, Texas area, and USA Gymnastics would like to establish a national team training center for potential Olympians at a future permanent site. Kansas City is in the running for one of those, but USA Gymnastics at the moment has a few other issues it is continuing to deal with. So as far as the timetable is concerned, USA Gymnastics hasn't stated a timetable, but you got to believe that it's not going to be something that's going to be happening maybe toward the end of this year, but more maybe toward 2020.
So the news today is that Kansas City is in the running for this facility, Greg?
Kansas City is in the running. USA Gymnastics wouldn't identify the other cities in the running, but you have to figure that one of those would be Sarasota, Florida, where the current team just had a team trial take place last week as the national team prepares for international Olympic events or international events like the Pan American Games this summer. And another major city I would think that would have to be in consideration would be Frisco, Texas, outside Dallas, because there are so many sports facilities being built there that it is almost becoming an Olympic complex because of the number of sports and the number of headquarters and headquartered sports outfits that are moving to that area.
I was going to say, I can't help but wonder, the team is holding its national championship competition in Kansas City in August. Was that a factor in the possibility that the team might be moving its training facility to Kansas City?
It is a factor, and in the words of Catherine Fox, who is the director of marketing sales for the Kansas City Sports Commission, she says that those ticket sales are, quote, incredibly well sold. That's something that USA Gymnastics definitely notices. And then when I asked her how to describe the gymnastics community of Kansas City, in her words, robust.
Oh, that's interesting. Another big news story this past weekend was Topeka native and KU Jayhawk golfer Gary Woodland winning the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. How had Woodland been doing on the tour prior to the Open? Because I wasn't familiar with him.
He had been contending. His last title was last year when he won in Phoenix, and he was the defending champion in Phoenix this year and actually played very well in the early part of the season, was knocking on the door to win a few events on the PGA Tour trail, but had not been able to come through with a victory this year. But the U.S. Open, I mean, you know, when you are introduced on the tee now for any tournament, to have that ring now at the tee, the 2019 U.S. Open champion, Gary Woodland, that's pretty special.
How good was his play at Pebble Beach?
It was outstanding, especially when you had Brooks Koepka, who had won two straight U.S. Open championships, was breathing down the neck of Gary Woodland. And Gary Woodland had been 0-for-7 when leading a tournament after 54 holes going into the final round. So with the pressure of overcoming that, plus Koepka breathing down his neck, Woodland was outstanding, punctuated by a signature 30-foot putt for a final round of 69 to win the championship.
So you got the defending champion breathing down your neck, a national TV audience, a live audience. I mean, that's That's real pressure.
It is real pressure. And I tell you, it's big for another reason, because Gary Woodland has been very vocal about trying to make one of the U.S. team events, like the President Cup or the Ryder Cup, and he has been left off those teams. He has put himself very much under consideration, not just because of his overall play, but because he could hit those pressure shots, as we saw on Sunday.
Sports contributor Greg Eklund is my guest. Let's move on to the World Cup, because Team USA has been on fire in the early play. They take on Sweden this afternoon. How formidable a challenge is this match going to be?
Well, the USA is expected to win. The USA team is the world's top-ranked team and was going into this championship. The anticipated match is the one against Japan. That seems to be the most severe test that the USA women have had, and everybody is waiting for that one to unfold.
But before this tournament, you're saying the team was expected to win
this
thing.
Yes, no doubt. The USA women have established themselves as the world power in women's soccer.
I was going to say, why is the team doing so well? What's happened here?
They have more emphasis, I would say, in this country on the women's game than other countries have. As you know, the men's game has been unable to catch up with the men around the world in other locations. But the women are far ahead in the pace of their standard of play than women elsewhere in the world.
So the interest in this tournament is going to grow as this
Absolutely.
Thing goes along,
oh,
here,
yeah.
you would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to the Kansas City Royals. They're in the midst of another 100-plus loss season, and you get the sense that Kansas Citians aren't too excited about all this. Are there flickers of hope for this team on the horizon? I mean, is there a reason to live going forward?
I'm not seeing it in the near future.
Is that right?
No. And I tell you, one of the things that has really caught up to the Royals at this point, Steve, is the fact that a few years ago you had the tragedy with the Yordano Ventura fatality. At this point of his career, he was expected to be in his prime and maybe as an anchor pitcher along mm-hmm. with Danny Duffy. Duffy has been inconsistent. He started out the year injured. Doing better lately. And the other starters who got a rookie year under their belt last year were expected to step it up this year. They've been inconsistent as well. And then when you strike out on first-round draft choices like Kyle Zimmer, who's still trying to figure it out, or Ash Russell, who was a number one draft choice that nobody's even heard of because he's fallen off the scene so quickly, those things have a way of catching up to the team, and they're feeling it right now.
Hmm. Well, that's discouraging.
Sorry to be the bearer of bad news there, Steve.
Well, they got this new draftee, the second pick in the draft,
right.
Bobby Witt Jr., the shortstop. Is this guy everything they say he's going to be?
He is what many will feel be an impact player. But we're seeing one on the field right now, Adalberto Mondesi.
Mm-hmm.
He is stepping it up. He's only 23 years old, and this is a budding superstar for the Royals right now.
I mean, do you see a core here going forward? You know, you got Hunter Dozier, you got Whit Merrifield, you have Mondesi. Is that enough of a core to sort of, then you have Bobby Witt coming down the pike?
Yeah.
Is that,
well,
do you see a makings of a World Series champion like the Royals had in 2013 going forward?
You have to consider the ages of those you just mentioned. When you talk about Mondesi, he's 23. Witt is just in his late teens right now, so he's going to be a young player and young impact player when he eventually makes the grade. But the others that you have mentioned, Hunter Dozier, Whit Merrifield, they're all in their late 20s right now. The window of opportunity on those guys is really running out.
Wow. Okay, let's move to Sporting KC just briefly. They're having something of an off year. What's wrong?
Injuries. Maybe the fact that they played in the CONCACAF tournament at the beginning of the year at the same time that the MLS team opened its season has had an effect, but this team has been decimated by injuries. They've been, and they also have had the inability to close out certain close matches in games that the Sporting Kansas City Football Club has been expected to win. They end up in ties, too many ties at this point of the season.
Just for the record, they're in 10th place in the Western Conference out of 12 teams.
Which would put them out of the playoffs.
I was going to say, that's not so whippy, is it?
They've got some ground to make up.
Okay, let's go to the Chiefs. Maybe one thing that everyone, more people are interested in, the Kansas City Chiefs. Two big questions, and let's start with this one. Is there any way for Pat Mahomes to be as good in year two as a starter as he was last year?
In a brief answer to your question, yes, he can be. But he's going to face a stiffer challenge this year because, for one, defensive coordinators around the league are getting plenty of time now in the offseason to figure out a way to stop him. And that's not something that can be minimized.
How do you stop him? Is there sort of a conventional wisdom that's emerged about that yet?
Well, one of his abilities to why he's able to play so well is his mobility and the way he's able to move around the pocket. There are some changes on the Chiefs' offensive line. If other teams can put pressure on him, contain him, keep him from running, but he doesn't run that much anyway, but at least contain him, there are ways that the defenses will set out to stop him.
What's the latest with Tyreek Hill? How much of a chance is there that he's still going to be on this team come fall? And if you don't have him, how big of a subtraction is that from this offense? Because that again, the thinking was that he really spread the defense out.
Sure. It's a huge distraction and a huge absence at the moment, and we don't know the future of him. He, unless otherwise anything comes out, he's still currently on suspension, and that's the position that the Chiefs have taken in regards to the issues off the field. But and then it's in the hands of the NFL as far as how long the NFL can and may suspend him. So those are all questions we don't know even as we speak going into training camp. But it would be a huge loss. It would be up to others to pick up that slack. And then that comes down to the original question. Can Patrick Mahomes be better? Well, he's better as much as the players around him because you have Travis Kelce coming off an ankle surgery in the offseason. He did not participate in the OTAs, the training camp offseason workouts. You have the possible absence of Tyreek. And we really don't know with a full season what Damian Williams will do because he filled in on the back. He filled in after the release of Kareem Hunt. We saw a nice spurt from him toward the end of the season. But what will we see from him for a full season?
I want to be clear about something. Is there a chance that Tyreek Hill could be on the roster of this team this fall? I know there's a chance, but is it realistic given everything that's transpired here?
Sure, there is a realistic chance, and there's a realistic chance that if the NFL suspension comes down, that it might be something less than a full season. So if he's still on the roster and things take place favorably off the field for him, then, yeah, there is a chance that he might be able to still be with this team.
Just give me 30 seconds here. The other big question I was going to ask, how much faith should we have in this new-look Chiefs defense?
I think a lot of faith. They've made a lot of changes. They have upgraded things with the free agent signing of Tyrann Mathieu and the pickup of Frank Clark in a trade, but what they need to do, they need to sign defensive tackle Chris Jones. He's holding out. He's in the last year of his contract. It's going to be costly, but he's the best returning player to this defense.
Okay, that's KCUR sports contributor Greg Eklund. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Today, the U.S. women's national soccer team will wrap up the first round of the World Cup tournament. The Americans have embraced their role as Goliath, shellacking their first two opponents 16 goals to zip. But the score isn't the only thing that's woefully uneven here, which concerns commentator Victor Wishna in this month's edition of A Fan's Notes.
Okay, today is my daughter's birthday, and I promised her I would say so on the air. Happy birthday, Vivian. She's 8. She loves reading and math, and Taylor Swift, and mac and cheese, and Hamilton. And her favorite sport is soccer. So it sure was swell of FIFA, or whoever does the actual scheduling for the Women's World Cup, to pick this afternoon for Team USA's final first-round match. If you haven't been paying attention, the top-ranked U.S. women's national team is the reigning World Cup champ and the favorite to repeat the feat this month in France. So far, the Americans have posted two dominating shutouts with essentially two completely different lineups. As the British newspaper The Guardian put it, they are the team that everyone wants to watch lose, which is just another way of saying the team that everyone wants to watch. But more than being better than everyone else, there's something else at stake. Being equal. 28 members of Team USA are currently suing their own National Soccer Federation, alleging purposeful gender discrimination in violation of the U.S. Civil Rights Act. Chief among the complaints is the claim that women at the highest level of U.S. soccer are paid roughly 38% of what their male counterparts make. This despite the fact that the women are far more successful than the men. The 13 goals in their opening rout of Thailand were not just a World Cup record, but more than their male colleagues have scored in the last four World Cup tournaments combined, including last year when they didn't even qualify. From TV ratings to Twitter followers, the women's team is also more popular than the men's and more profitable, too, with three times the net earnings last year. The latest women's final, in 2015, was the most-watched soccer match in American television history. It will be months, perhaps, before the lawsuit works its way through federal court. But this Women's World Cup, with its unprecedented media attention, has shined the brightest spotlight yet on the inequities between male athletes and the women who play the same games. It has become a referendum on women's sports in general. And look, I understand, no one really needs one more man's opinion on this matter. But indulge me, as someone who follows sports rather closely, in a little bit of fansplaining. You see, the U.S. women's team is among the best in any sport in history, but also more exciting to watch. Forget the scoreboard. Each goal was dramatic. Each exuberant celebration, for which, of course, they were critiqued, was genuine and contagious. So as a fan, these are players I want to keep happy. And yes, you could argue, great, but it's sports, not minimum wage labor. Getting paid to play a game that eight-year-olds love? The world has bigger problems. But this matters because the world is watching, from the stands in Paris to the couch in our living room. And if this World Cup is a referendum on women's sports, then it's a referendum on all of us. Look, I don't care if my daughter grows up to be a professional athlete. Frankly, I'm hoping that one day she cures cancer or drops out of college to launch a billion-dollar startup. Ultimately, whatever makes her happy. But I sure as hell don't want her to come of age in a world where her efforts are valued at a fraction of what a man earns for the same work, especially when she's better at it. So, of course, we'll be cheering for Team USA in today's match against Sweden, and I hope they go all the way, to the Supreme Court, if necessary. Routes are fun to watch, but any soccer fan from age 8 to 88 will tell you the most exciting goal and the most important in any game is the one that ties the score, the one they call the equalizer.
Victor Wishnev is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Up next, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably should brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is a lot of brains been old polished. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough. A shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older.
I think everybody's going to recognize exactly what that is. Brian McTavish is here to talk about some fun stuff to do on the upcoming warm weekend. Welcome back.
How warm?
It's going to be warm, I think. I don't know.
It's going to be tomorrow. Sizzling hot.
Yes.
At Hamilton.
Yes.
At the Kansas City Music Hall, actually through July 7, but it touched down at the Music Hall this week.
It opens up, what, Friday night?
I think it's on stage.
Yeah.
Opened up a day or two ago.
Yeah.
It is the, as you may well know, as listeners may well know, the hippest of all histories about America's $10 founding father. Finally makes it to KC in all its Tony Award-winning glory. Now, the content of this is actually based on a legit Alexander Hamilton biography, right?
Yes.
Even though the music is all over the place, it's so innovative. Hip-hop, jazz, rap, blues, R&B, pop, and of course those old Broadway-style tunes. Do we have time for a little history about Alexander Hamilton? Okay, so on July 11, I don't know the time of day. It was, I don't know the time of day, maybe high noon, 1804, on July 11, the former Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, and the sitting vice president at the time, it's hard to believe, Aaron Burr, they got together in Weehawken, New Jersey, and the long and the short of it is that Burr shot and mortally wounded Hamilton in a duel. I guess they had a grievance or two. Now, Hamilton died, but of course he's more alive than ever with this musical, right?
Right.
But along with Hamilton's death, also dying was what was left of Burr's declining political career, which was effectively wiped out when he killed Hamilton. I guess people didn't react very well to that. Couple of real quick funny things.
That'll do it.
I did not know this. Burr later in life said that, quote, "I should have known the world was wide enough for Hamilton and me." Does that show regret? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe not, because he was also quoted as saying on more than one occasion after offing Hamilton, "My friend Hamilton, who I shot," he would often begin a statement about Hamilton, which was a joke, but not taken very well at the time. I guess it was even then tasteless. Anyway, all of these interesting characters or actual real-life history people are brought to the stage in a way that may never, you know, there's going to be a movie version. There's got to be.
Oh, is that right?
Well, there's got to be.
I mean, come on. Are there tickets? Can you get a ticket?
There's always a ticket.
There's a will, there's a way.
Where there's a wallet, there's a way. So check it out. Hamilton, it's here for two or three more weeks, but hey, try to get in this weekend. You can do it. Alexander's all for it.
What do we have here?
Kind of sounds like a robot.
Yes, it does.
Kind of sounds like somebody making something with technology. And so we shall move on.
That's what we're talking
about. Yes, you direct me accordingly.
The music matches the event.
Well, and sometimes at your behest, I have to explain the music.
Yes.
And that's okay, too. Okay, it's the Kansas City Maker Faire. It's back. It's the place where engineers and artists and scientists and crafters and people who are curious about such other people, it's where they all get together and you see what people make and they're happy to show and tell you what they make. It's 10 to 6 Saturday. It's 10 to 5 Sunday. Sunday. It's at Union Station. The organizers call it the greatest show and tell on earth. Let me just share with you some. I mean,
please.
The list of things is very long, and we don't have time to go over it all, but I'll do my best to touch on some highlights. How about Tipsy Robot Racing? How about R2-D2 Builders Group, right? There's a lot of these R2-D2s running around.
What was the first one? Tipsy?
Tipsy Robot Racing. Now, certainly, these are sober robots, because, as you know, the last thing you want to do...
That was not what I was thinking.
...is give a martini to a robot. They do not hold their liquor well. There will be assorted robotics demos and other robo races, but it's very... so much stuff. Hat making will be featured. Beekeeping. If you don't know how to draw, learn how to use a drawing machine. You can learn how to go from fleece to garment. Right? Right in front of your very eyes.
All this at Union Station.
Oh, yeah. And cosplay costume crafting, including fur suit making. You know, I knew there was something I wanted to learn.
Okay.
How to make a good fur suit. Together? Want to go?
No.
Next
up. That makes you want to move. That's why we're playing that song, because
See?
There's a connection with the event.
All
You're
right.
so clever at that.
Well,
let's move.
And thank
we're
you.
We're going to move because...
Thank you for supporting that. Okay, so we're going to race through these at best, although I prefer to walk not run. So I have several, three or four Saturday in Motion things to do. First, and perhaps foremost, is the Great Amazing Race Kansas City. It's a family-friendly adventure run walk. I do prefer the walking. It kicks off at 4 o'clock, register at 1:30 Saturday at the Frank Soccer Fields in Lee's Summit. All ages. But basically, you have two-person teams, mm-hmm. and it can be kid, adult. You know, it can be two 80-year-olds, an 80-year-old, and a 5-year-old. That would be fun. And they go around, and they run around, and they get clue cards, and they try to figure things out before the other two-person teams do. It's based on that show we never watch, The Amazing Race, on TV. Also, Saturday, kicking off at 7 in the morning, it's the Run to Serve the World 5K. Go to Evangel Church in Kansas City if you want to run to serve the world. Okay, also, Saturday, from 11 to 5, it's the Westwood Art Show, the very first Westwood
Art Show. That's my town, Westwood.
Well, you'll be there.
I'll be there.
Even if you're not there, you're there, right? Because you live there. Westwood Art Show, it's a sidewalk. Get it? Sidewalk. Walk. Arts and crafts sale.
Yeah, I get it.
Well, you do?
Yeah.
Well, all right. At the Farmer's House, which is kind of a general store in Westwood, and they'll be also showing their brand new art studio there. And last but not least in this category, it's the Humboldt Penguin March. Let's not leave critters out. 11 to 11:15. It's a quick march. 11 to 11:15, Saturday and Sunday mornings at the Kansas City Zoo.
We can dance if we want to. We can leave your friends behind. Because your friends don't dance, and if they don't dance, well, they're no friends of mine. Say, we can go where we want to, place where they will never find.
What do we have here?
Okay, the year was 1983.
Men without hats.
The year was 1983, and Men Without Hats had a song, a music video on early MTV.
Mm-hmm.
And that video, as primitive as it was, as silly as it was, catapulted them to one-hit wonder fame.
Wow.
Because it's called the safety dance. If you were around watching The Tube in 1983, you may very well want to check out this show. The headliner is actually Howard Jones,
mm-hmm.
and he's very nice. But it happens at 8:30 Saturday night at Star Pavilion at Ameristar Casino. Now, Howard Jones, he had some hits. He had Everlasting Love. He had What Is Love. He had, you know what... He had no, what is it? You know I love you, don't you? I don't even like that question, but I guess it was
they all love each other.
Yeah, yeah, they all love each other. Go check out that synth pop thing this weekend.
And finally today.
We want the bomb. Say what? Yeah, not the bomb. Come on. We need the bomb.
This is a farewell tour for this guy, right?
That's right.
George Clinton.
Yeah, you did a little reading before the show. That's good. Okay, so One Nation Under a Groove tour. He is saying so long. He will be 78 next month. Nothing lasts forever.
Yes.
But I guess all you need is funk. 7 o'clock Saturday, KC Crossroads.
And there's going to be funk.
At Grinders. Two questions. Do you want the funk?
Yes.
Can you
handle the funk? Hauser, but this funk.
Oh,
yes.
No, really? Well,
this
I'll leave
is the real
alone.
Funk.
Can you handle it?
Yes.
Okay. Get psychedelic. Go science fiction. Strange bits of humor. Innovator of funk, funking himself into a wonderful...
Be careful. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to do. You said it right, but I just was getting nervous with your weekend to-do
list. If you're nervous, I'm nervous.
Tomorrow on the show, two freshman lawmakers in the Kansas and Missouri House of Reps on their first session in office. What went well and what didn't? We'll find out. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.